Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. I'm your host, Bill Wirtz. On this 22nd of July, 2021, little ad from our colleagues at Consumer Choice Radio.
Government has become too big, too overtaxing, and is constantly overregulating every aspect of your life.
If you agree with that, tune in to Consumer Choice Radio every Saturday at 10 a.m. here on the Big Talker 106.7 FM. With me, Yael Osowski.
And me, David Clement. For an hour, you'll get expert analysis on what the government is sinking its teeth into next and how you, as a consumer, can push back.
ConsumerChoiceRadio.com.
Great guest this week, Deepak Anand, is joining us at the end of this episode to chat about Europe's experiment with both medicinal and recreational cannabis. He is the CEO and co-founder of Materia, which supplies and distributes medical cannabis and CBD products globally, and has been advising the UK, Cyprus, and Maltese governments on cannabis policy. You'll find the entire exchange at the end of this episode. Also in this episode, Russia bans champagne and Europe's digital tax is on hold. So, of course, starting off with some bubbly, or not, depending on who you ask, because Russian President Vladimir Putin has been passing a new law that requires importers of champagne to label their drinks as sparkling wine as opposed to champagne. That specific name will be reserved for only Russian producers. This is, of course, mostly to upset the French, I assume, who have been very insistent on the protection of their food origin labels. Of course, these origin labels are very important in European trade deals. Whenever we make trade deals, the different producers all around Europe, including in Italy and Spain, are very insistent on their local production to be protected. Overall, this has caused quite some ruckus. The European Commissioner Dombrovskis has said that this is probably not compliant with World Trade Organization rules, and of course, as you'll be able to hear right now, not everyone is very happy about it.
Tensions between Moscow and French winemakers bubbled over on Monday when France's champagne industry group called on its members to halt all shipments of the fizzy beverage to Russia over a new law signed by Russian President Vladimir Putin that forces foreign champagne producers to add the words sparkling wine to their labels. The law requires all non-Russian producers of sparkling wine to describe their product as such on the back of every bottle, but Russian makers of champagne may continue to use that term alone. In response, France's Champagne Wine Professionals Committee said all shipments to Russia should be halted for the time being, and said the name Champagne, which refers to the region in France the drink comes from, had legal protection in 120 countries. Charles Gomer is the committee's director general.
It's tragic for the producers who are losing the legitimate right to use this name. It's also tragic for our business with Russia because, at least temporarily, champagne wines will no longer be able to be exported to Russia because they no longer conform with the rules.
The Champagne Committee also called on French and European Union diplomats to get the law changed. Meanwhile, Moët Hennessy, the maker of Dom Pérignon, said on Sunday that it would comply with the law and begin adding the word sparkling wine to the back of bottles destined for Russia.
So overall, I think this ultimately just shows the ridiculousness of these origin rules. I mean, I understand that certain regions in Europe are very fond of their products and food products overall that are produced in a certain way with a certain tradition. But overall, this comes down to the entire labeling discussion when it comes to food. You don't need these restrictive labeling rules. You can just have positive labeling. Whether or not a Moët Chandon is labeled as sparkling wine or not, you will still see the value in that product because of the label and because of the name of that product. So nothing prevents the champagne producers in France from putting a bright golden label that says this is an original product of France and it's produced in accordance to the rules of the French Republic. So ultimately, this is just a stupid spat between countries that are just trying to diplomatically find a reason to be in the news again. I think it's very silly, but I also think that it is silly to restrict trade rules because of these names. You know, if somebody in the Amazon forest wants to make Parmigiano cheese, as long as it says on the product where it's from, consumers will be able to decide. And maybe you like Parmigiano cheese that is from Brazil. I think ultimately this comes down to the entire conversation about what constitute the authentic products. It's a bit similar to the whole veggie burger ban that we had in discussing in the European Parliament for a long time. Consumers know that a veggie burger doesn't contain meat. And consumers also know that these sparkling wine or champagne labels don't mean much to them as long as they like the product. And I think that's ultimately what it comes down to. And I really hope that politics doesn't really have to get caught up so much in these labeling conversations. And then also news is that the digital tax by the European Commission seems to be on hold. This is because the global taxation conversation is still going on, and the European countries want to wait until that is concluded before introducing a digital tax. So another tax on top of the already discussed global minimum tax and redistribution of the profits of big corporations. We've seen this rise of the digital services tax. This entire conversation started in 2018. This was mostly based on the lobbying of French Minister Bruno Le Maire. He is of the opinion that these big digital companies are making too much and have too strong of a position. I think my colleague Yal in the show that he guest hosted has pointed out that it's a bit of a double standard going on there, because the companies that are being targeted are Microsoft, Amazon, Apple, and Facebook. And of course, nobody talks about the dominant position on the music streaming market, which is Spotify, which is a Swedish company. So of course, we seem to just target the American incumbents, or like the big companies in that sphere, but we're not looking at our European counterparts. Of course, we took this to other industries. In other industries, Europe is way more performant. And of course, we would take it as a protectionist measure if now the United States were to implement similar rules. So ultimately, I don't think this is a good idea. But just a bit of background again on the DST, the digital services tax. According to KPMG, the tax is set to generate 2-3% of the country's government revenues from a narrow group of large internet companies. Although rates slightly differ between member states, 7.5% in Hungary and 3% in France, the target is generally the same: large multinationals. So in 2018, the Commission launched this proposal, and then there was some discussion, and Sweden and Ireland were not too keen about that. I think Sweden also because they considered that Spotify might be targeted after all. And then despite the lack of compromise, member states went on to introduce the DST on national levels anyway. So as a result, Austria, Belgium, the Czech Republic, France, Hungary, Italy, Poland, Slovenia, and Spain have proposed, announced, or are already implementing some sort of a digital tax. Under current international tax rules, a country where multinational service companies are subject to corporate income tax is generally determined by the place where production occurs rather than where consumers or users are. So the idea here being that, so for instance, Google sells a lot of ads and people are buying these ad spaces online, and they are buying those while being in France, but this doesn't quite apply on the taxation rules, because then Google is located not in France directly, and they're purchasing these services somewhere else. And then, of course, France gets to see no digital tax revenue from that. But ultimately, I think the conversation needs to be about like who pays these taxes. I think we bring this up in multiple episodes, but this is super important to know about, is that these companies will just pass on these taxes to the consumer. And for those small businesses that are trying to get the word out of their services through Instagram ads or Facebook ads or whatever, if the prices rise for these companies to advertise, they have even less of a chance to challenge the big incumbents. So ultimately, this is just a market distortion. I don't think it's very very fruitful to go about this. So while Austria and Hungary are taxing just advertising, in France, Turkey, and Italy, the tax scope is much broader. It includes revenues from providing a digital interface, targeted advertising, and data transmission about users for advertising purposes. Higher costs for advertising are likely to result in higher prices for these companies' products and services. According to a 2019 study on the economic impact of the French digital service tax, quote, approximately 55% of the total tax burden will be borne by consumers, 40% by businesses that use digital platforms, and only 5% by the large internet companies targeted. So we see some evidence there that, again, it is not the big companies that end up paying these taxes. So not really achieving the aim. It does increase revenues for governments, but the pretended reason to implement them, that is just not valid. But now let's move to the interview of this week. As I said, my guest this week is Deepak Anand. He is a policy advisor on all things cannabis and a very interesting guy to talk to. He had a lot to say about CBD, medicinal cannabis and recreational cannabis in Europe as we are continuing that experiment with legalizing, which of course we as the Consumer Choice Center much support. So listen to our exchange and hopefully it's very educational. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Consumer Podcast. You are in so many different advising and jobs and ventures when it comes to the cannabis space. And of course, not all of our listeners are very familiar with this topic. So just to get some background on you briefly, how did you get into this space? Because, you know, cannabis wasn't like 20 years ago. It was like a policy area for some advocacy, but there wasn't much that you could do on the business side. So how does one go from a, let's say, traditional business to the cannabis space?
Yeah, Bill, thanks a lot for having me, and really appreciate being on, speaking on this topic. So how I got into cannabis, of course, was by chance. I've been involved in the pharmaceutical side of things for a very long time and spent quite a bit of time both in Europe as well as in North America on the cannabis, on sort of the pharmaceutical file. But cannabis came about, obviously, as a result of Canada having been the first G7 country to have legalized cannabis at a federal or a national level. Was a pretty significant policy move, and was very happy to have played a very tiny part in that process, working as a stakeholder with the Government of Canada on first the medical cannabis file and then the recreational cannabis file as well. And so that's how I got into it. Was I was very curious about cannabis coming from the pharmaceutical side, where there was always the stigma associated with cannabis, and the quote unquote war on drugs was of course very, very, very very popularly sort of floated around in North America and certainly in my own mind. And so I was very curious when the Government of Canada sort of, said to me that they were looking at legalizing first for medical and then for recreational purposes. And so that curiosity actually ended up, leading me and bringing me into this.
And for our listeners on the Brussels policy side, of course, some of them have also not really had any contact with advisors or lobbyists in that space. It sounds, when you say the word like cannabis lobbyist or cannabis policy advisor, it's still, there's a bit of a smirk that still goes with it. Is the industry a mature industry?
Look, I think the industry itself is developing. Canada has now had a recreational cannabis program for just over, 3 years, coming up in 3 years, actually in October. And then we've had a medical cannabis program in this country for far greater than 10 years. So, having said that, I think the cannabis industry itself might be in its infancy and sort of, in the nascent stage. However, the question you asked on the policy side is one that's actually quite advanced. Canada, as I said earlier, being the first G7 country, has had to figure out and really lead and pave the way in a number of different policy fronts. There are UN treaties that needed to be considered around legalization. There was implications associated with that. There was banking issues. There was just simply regulatory policy that, came first on medical and then on recreational. And so Canada has really led the way from that perspective. So I think there's really a roadmap here that was created by Canada. Now, certainly we haven't gotten everything perfectly in that, and the government itself was very, very admitting to that early on, that, this is definitely going to be a process, not an event. I think countries have an opportunity to further fine tune, sort of the legalization file, but Canada set an excellent roadmap. So on the policy side, I would say, there's definitely a lot that has been done here, and there's a lot to learn.
And you also advise countries in Europe and sort of, you know, we don't want any services here free of charge, but of course we are interested. What kind of problems do these governments approach you with? What are the questions? I mean, you mentioned the UN treaties, for instance. That seems to be one of the headaches that governments are facing. So how do we navigate this international space of trade and getting on the medicinal side as well, getting the cannabis that patients need without production necessarily being legal in the country that legalized medicinal cannabis? So give us sort of an overview as to what European governments are facing here in terms of the challenges.
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, first and foremost, I think the one of the biggest challenges that Europe is currently facing on this file is just the lack of harmonization, right? I think harmonization is a concept that kind of conversation that comes up regularly as it relates to many things in Europe with respect to the single market and kind of making sure all countries within the union have a similar framework. And if you look at cannabis, there's nothing further than being fragmented than cannabis, because you've got Denmark as an example that has a trial program on the one hand, and you know, Germany that has quite a robust medical framework on the other, and you've got France and Italy that have their own versions of things that are coming out. And you've got, Spain and Portugal and Cyprus and Malta that have, another varying set of different things. So I think it's very fragmented. So harmonization is probably one of the biggest things that comes up in a lot of conversations, and harmonization first and foremost for medical. I mean, you know, the recreational conversation is still very, very early on in places like Luxembourg and Switzerland, but at least even on medical, having a common kind of harmonized framework is something that most countries are trying to understand how they get to. And just because, you know, the way that these programs have been set up have been so fundamentally different from each other, that trying to get to harmonization is going to be a challenge itself. So I'd say on the medical side, that's certainly one challenge. Fortunately, UN treaties are not a large issue from a medical perspective, because there is a carve out where, cannabis, much like other controlled substances, can be traded and are traded for medical and scientific purposes. So not a huge challenge there on the medical side, but certainly something that's coming up on the recreational side. If you look at places like Luxembourg, Switzerland, most recently, Malta and Cyprus, those conversations have already started to happen around sort of how you deal with UN treaties and sort of what you do about this. And, most recently we've seen, quite a bit of movement, I'd say, on that file where, you know, at least the schedule with respect the UN treaties has changed on cannabis and particularly THC. So there has been some positive movement there, and you know, people are starting to have this conversation at an international kind of United Nations level already. So there's certainly a lot of movement there. But those are some of the sort of first nuggets that come up when dealing with policy, and particularly from a European perspective, harmonization seems to be one of the biggest challenges.
Well, on harmonization, how likely do you think it is that the European Union will eventually have to get around and, you know, create a common framework on this level? Or do you think that European countries will have to do bilateral treaties or international treaties outside of the European Union? What is most likely there?
Yeah, I think, the conversation's already started. I think the objective is to first deal with cannabis flowers. Obviously, in cannabis, there's the flowers, the extracts, and a variety of different formulations. I think cannabis flowers have already started to become a topic of harmonization. I think that Germany specifically has done a lot of work over the years around developing a fairly robust regulatory framework that they currently operate under. So, and they've already started heading up a working group for which other countries like Portugal, Malta, et cetera, that are involved in different aspects of the industry are starting to participate in. So I think those conversations have already started. I think it's quite likely that we will see a harmonized framework. I don't think we're expecting to see it anytime soon. It's going to be quite a process to get there, but I think people have started to realize that this is something that we all need to work towards, right? And I think as the larger countries like France, Italy, soon Spain come online, the need for that is definitely quite significant, because the disparity that medical cannabis patients face across Europe is vast and diverse, right? And that's completely opposite from the single market, free movement of goods and people foundation that the European Union is based on. It's completely opposite to that, where you could be in Germany and you could have your medical cannabis covered by the federal government, and you could be in France, where just until recently it was only a trial program, and so effectively prior to that you wouldn't have any access. And there's other countries in Europe where you don't have any access at all, period. It's completely illegal. So the disparity is quite significant. And when you look at this truly from a foundational perspective, you know, you being a European citizen are not limited to pharmaceutical products, regardless of which country within the union that you end up in. So, you know, that's certainly one of the overarching challenges.
What I've noticed when going to cannabis policy conferences is that there's different kinds of people, there's different kinds of views on the medicinal and recreational conversation. Some people, some industries will say, well, don't mix us up in the recreational argument. That will just make it more difficult for us to argue when we talk to governments. And the others will say, well, you can't de-link the two. We need to have a conversation about both, and those conversations can be had at the same time. Where do you fall on that discussion?
Look, I mean, having, you know, this is what I keep saying to a lot of European counterparts and friends and colleagues in the industry. I mean, you know, having been in Canada, we have the benefit of hindsight, which is something we didn't have prior to setting up this program. But now that we've had a program for a few years, you know, we have that rearview mirror to look in and say, what happened, you know, way back? And, you know, can we draw back on conclusions? And so I'd say, you know, Canada was certainly strategic in setting up a medical cannabis framework first, and then looking at a recreational cannabis policy subsequent to that. I realized that, you know, given geography and the way that certain European countries are physically located, it might not even make sense for them to look at cultivation of cannabis necessarily, even though there's, you know, UN implications that come around making sure that recreational cannabis can't cross borders. But notwithstanding that fact, I think that, you know, where the conversation is on cannabis generally now, it seems to be a lot more mature, it seems to be a lot more advanced, and countries are starting to get ahead around it. And I think that countries like Germany that have now had a medical cannabis program are cultivating medical cannabis in country, are well positioned to be able to take on the recreational cannabis conversation. I think that countries that have never dealt with any sort of cultivation, any sort of regulatory regime around cultivation of cannabis, typically first for medical purposes, will find it a little bit more challenging to start to legislate and regulate the entire enchilada, both medical and recreational at the same time. It would be advisable to look at medical cannabis first, and then recreational cannabis subsequent to that. But the other side of this coin is that, you know, consumers are accessing cannabis for a variety of different purposes, whether legal or illegal, whether right or wrong, and countries need to get ahead of this. So you can't necessarily wait to set up a medical program first, then develop a recreational program. Second, I do feel like there's some urgency around this. There's no debating that this is going to be mainstream. This is an industry that's here to stay. It will be present in Europe. You know, there will be recreational cannabis legalization in Europe. It's a matter of sort of when, not if. So, you know, I think that's the overarching thing.
Do some European countries, I mean, there's the approach of saying, well, the prohibition hasn't worked, and that's one part of the argument. The other part of the argument being like, we need it for medical purposes, and it's just even for self-medicational purposes. Do some European countries also approach this from an economical perspective, by which they say, well, this is actually good for our economy and our farming sector? Is that also some of the approach that you see in your work?
Yes, I not only see it in my work, I also see it being a challenge. And what I mean by that is we've seen a number of island nations, you know, a number of British overseas territories, you know, countries like Morocco outside of the European Union even start to look at this from a strictly an economic perspective. And there's a flaw in that theory. And the flaw is that the global cannabis market is still very much in its infancy and is very nascent. And so the total addressable market, as venture capitalists that, you know, typically like to look at this, is still very small. It is going to grow. It is going to be mainstream. There's no disputing that. But to set up an entire industry around exports with no consideration paid to domestic sort of issues is where I see countries going to run into challenges, because now you've got, you know, about, you know, a handful of countries, you know, 5-6 countries now that have said that they want to make this an economic mandate, which is great to see. But the challenge is you can't have an economic mandate for exports whilst ignoring your own citizens in country. And that's where you start to, you know, get into challenges around that. And there's some large countries that if they were to look in their own backyard and actually created an effective program so that people, A, weren't unfairly kind of, you know, prosecuted for cannabis, which continues to happen despite an export industry. You look at the UK, I think it's a classical example of that irony, where they're the largest exporter of medical cannabis on the global stage, yet it's, you know, it's impossible for patients to get access to medical cannabis in country, and you know, no recreational legalization. So that's, you know, quite a bit of a contradiction right there in itself. So I'm cautious about those sorts of things, and I caution countries about taking on too much of an economic mandate, because you know, the file is slow to move. But I think if they start to legislate locally, that's going to get the wheel spinning even faster, and there's going to create more of a, so as to say, total addressable market on a global level.
You just mentioned the UK, and I think pre-recording, we already talked a bit about this example. I just wanted to get just sort of your description and your view on how the UK's policy landscape on the medicinal cannabis issue has somehow shifted with one specific issue, one specific case. Can you just elaborate on that?
For sure. So, I mean, you know, Charlotte Caldwell and Billy Caldwell, Billy was, you know, one of the children that, you know, had suffered some severe pediatric epilepsy, and was certainly one of the children that we worked with very closely to be able to get Charlotte and his mother and Billy his medicine. And that sort of led to at least a transformation in the medical cannabis kind of policy side in the UK. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done. But nonetheless, it was stories like that and patients like Billy that have resulted in the NHS, the Home Office, and a variety of other regulators to wake up and see that, you know, this is, you know, this medicine is actually benefiting patients. In Billy's case, at least, you know, the NHS is starting to cover some of the costs. At least Charlotte's hoping to get that done. But they're starting to realize that, you know, you need to start to develop policy and legislation around this, and you know, and you need to move on that. So, you know, while Germany, of course, is much more open with respect to physicians prescribing medical cannabis and patients being reimbursed through the federal government for it, UK is very, very far away from either having a large number of prescriptions or being reimbursed or covered. I think that there's a lot of ground to be covered in the UK with respect to that on the medical cannabis side. But nonetheless, the conversations have started. Regulators have started to pay very close attention around this, and are starting to develop frameworks around, you know, creating sort of an industry around, you know, obviously first the medical cannabis side. So, you know, that's what's happening in the UK. A lot of work to be done, but progress is being made. And I'd say the UK it certainly seems to be an area for growth, probably, you know, one of the largest areas that we'll see growth on the medical cannabis side in the coming years.
Excellent. So I have one more thing, because we're getting to the end of this segment, and we talked a lot about the policy. So, but I also have one specific consumer question. We see this bit of a significant increase, actually, of CBD products on the market. There's a bunch of shops that I can go to now that offer all types of different CBD products, from lipsticks to creams to drops to everything. And to many consumers, this is a new type of product, and they don't quite know exactly how to navigate that, and if they should or can self-medicate for different problems with these CBD products. Do you have specific advice for consumers who are looking at these products for their personal use and they don't know exactly what to do? What should they do? Where can they, should they talk to their doctor? Should they just scroll online and find whatever? What is the best way to go about this for consumers listening?
Yeah, quite a loaded question there. So a couple of things, you know, just to, you know, we were talking about the UK on the medical cannabis side very quickly. I think one of the smart, strategic, and actually quite forward-looking things that the UK has done on the CBD file, at least, is looked at creating something called the novel foods legislation, which applies to both UK and Europe. You know, UK had this prior to Brexit, but are continuing down that path even post-Brexit. And basically what the UK government said is that, look, we know CBD is mainstream. It's in every sort of high street shop. It's in every supermarket. It's in every grocery store, pharmacy, department store, et cetera. And so we know that consumers, for whatever reason, are coming to CBD and they're using CBD for whatever purposes. We want to make sure that the product they're putting into their bodies is A, safe, and B, stable. So make sure that those two elements are taken care of. And I think that's actually quite a pragmatic approach, because you know, whether it works or not, whether there's efficacy or not, I mean, there's a whole bunch of data and a whole bunch of theories around that. And I don't think we've reached any definitive conclusions. I don't think CBD is a silver bullet. I think it certainly helps people with a number of their conditions, but consumers need to be cautious cautious around the product that they're actually buying. And I think this is where regulators actually come in. I know you did, you wanted to move away from policy, but unfortunately, this is one of the bigger kind of, you know, policy things that actually needs to happen, is that, you know, whether it be novel foods or whether it be any other legislation, I think governments need to make sure that products that are being put on shelves are actually what they say they are. And that's the challenge in Europe right now, is that you've got a bunch of CBD products that can say 10,000 milligrams of CBD. It may contain nothing. It may contain a whole bunch of other ingredients that are harmful to people. So I think it's incumbent on governments to make sure that products that are being put on shelves, that are being sold to consumers, actually contain what they say they're going to contain. If there's other ingredients in them, making sure that those two ingredients when combined are safe and stable in their condition. So I think that's just a basic level. I think part of the challenge has been is that the industry has gotten very far ahead of itself with respect to where this has been. You know, consumers have, as I said, wanted products, and regulators haven't had a chance to get up to speed. I think Europe in particular was further challenged by this, because you've had a Canna Vape case in France where, you know, at one point Europe was considering, you know, ruling CBD as a narcotic and banning it completely. And then you had this European Court of Justice ruling not too long ago, a few months ago, actually overturn that ruling and say that, you know, the free movement principle applies to CBD. So now regulators are going to have to very quickly get up to speed. And I think you need to start from a base level where it's like, if this says a certain thing on the bottle, it needs to be what it's in there. So I think that's the first step in that. I think consumers just need to be very cautious and make sure that, you know, where they can speak to physicians about it and get educated and certainly do your research, but make sure the company that you're buying products from actually can produce something called a certificate of analysis that actually shows what the product is. It went through a lab, it was tested, and it was actually put out, so you have some comfort around that, absent any major legislation.
And that concludes this week's episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow Deepak Anand at @_DeepakAnand on Twitter. And of course, follow the Consumer Choice Center on Twitter as well at @ConsumerChoiceC. As always, I'm your host, Bill Wirtz. See you Thursday. You have to learn.